listen, and what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Don't let them tell you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Well, a great hearty welcome to all of you out there to a show called Thinking Clearly. It's a show about critical thinking and related topics. My name's Bob Frelick, and I'm with co-host...
I'm Julia Minton.
Yeah.
It's great to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, and we have a great guest, and I'll tell you a little bit, folks out there, what the topic is as we go along. But we're going to do a little bit of kind of introductory show business, business about our show, I should say. For example, how do you contact us if folks feel motivated to contact us one way or the other? How would they go about doing that?
We love hearing from our audience. If you're in the digital realms like I am, you can find us on Facebook. If you put in Thinking Clearly, chances are it's going to come up. So you can find us there as well. And I'm a big podcasting fan because I get to listen on my own time. And you can also subscribe to our podcast feed. Just open up your podcast app, search for Thinking Clearly, and you'll find our radio show.
Yeah, and after we do each show, we do a link on our Facebook page that actually links you to the podcast so that you don't have to do a search if you don't want to. Just come to our Facebook page, make a comment. So I'm going to just give you the short definition because we do have a guest and a pretty robust topic that we're going to try to unpack.
This show, never.
So get your slide rules out. But at any rate...
Do you still have a slide rule?
I do.
Do you have one I can borrow?
I don't know what you do with it, actually, but yes. Do you know how to use a slide rule?
No, I don't. But I bet I could look it up on YouTube.
I'll bet you could. But at any rate, if you're new to this show or if you want a little bit of refresher on what critical thinking is, we have a very long description because it's really a robust topic and it has a lot of aspects to it. But the
could you give us sort of an abstract, though?
Kind of an abstract. The abstract short version of critical thinking is that you look for evidence. If you have a concern, an issue that you're wondering about, that you're curious about, somebody has a position on something, and or you heard a claim about something and want to make a claim about something, the first step is to look for evidence. Mm-hmm. You do some research and look for evidence. And we are so blessed in this day and age to have the internet, because the internet is a wonderful starting point for doing some research.
It's really easy for me to find people that agree with me on the internet.
Yes, but the idea is to do a robust search, a comprehensive search. So you're not just confirming your biases that you have or trying to disconfirm someone else's position. What you're doing is you're looking at all the aspects, all the evidence that's out there. You're doing a very comprehensive, throwing out a big net. Then you have to sort of evaluate that evidence. What's the source of the evidence? How is it presented? Do you understand it? Do you need something to check that claim, that piece of evidence with? Sometimes it can get a little bit complex, but believe me, it is a way to achieve ownership. And then you link that piece of evidence and come to a conclusion using logic. So you use, and we've talked about the different processes in logic, deductive logic and inductive logic. And we're going to go back and review all that stuff. Reasoning from evidence using logic.
Oh, there we go.
All right. You got me to shorten it up. It's tough for me to... to be brief and terse. All right, so the topic tonight is a very important topic to critical thinkers, but one that we oftentimes don't even think about, or maybe we're not even aware of what we're doing when we're doing it. But the topic is understanding risk-benefit assessment And we're considering that another tool for critical thinking. And we do have a guest who I'm excited to bring on to the show here as soon as we can. I'm going to give a little bit of introductory information. His name is Daniel Cole. He's a professor in both the Maurer School of Law and the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. He's an internationally recognized environmental law and economics scholar, and he's authored 9 books, around 60 articles. His interests include environmental and natural resources law and economics and the politics of property. Professor Cole, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to be on the show.
Thanks for joining us. I just want to remind listeners real quick that we will be taking calls from listeners if you have questions for Professor Cole on the topic of assessing risks and benefits. We're going to open the lines about 7:45 or a little bit after, and we'll give you the numbers then. And we do love hearing from our audience.
Let me kind of frame the discussion a little bit and give a little bit of reason why we're choosing this topic and inviting the professor to help us reason through it and understand it better. Because as critical thinkers, we are all the time really faced with trying to construct some kind of a position about maybe political policy, immigration, for example, or various technologies like nuclear power or genetic engineering of food crops. Things like that come up all the time for us. And yet many of us, myself included, don't know how to appropriately analyze the risk versus the benefit in such matters. And it turns out that it's considerably complex and difficult to do so, as far as I understand how the experts do it. So often what we do is just kind of simply engage our fast, intuitive, emotional processing that we've called System 1 on this show to create a feeling about an issue at hand that we're concerned with as being either good or bad. Whereas the experts that study this and do this have developed a fairly rigorous quantitative methods for assessing risk and benefits. So, Professor, let's start with a discussion of the intuitive versus analytic methods that I talked about, and give us kind of your big picture introduction to risk-benefit analysis 101.
All right. Well, that's a big question. But you're quite right that most of us in our daily lives use mental shortcuts basically to calculate the risks that we take on every day. When we decide to get in the car to go somewhere, we're taking certain risks relating to driving. If we walk instead of drive, we're taking certain risks with respect to being a pedestrian. So calculating these risks, you know, we're not human calculators. We are boundedly rational creatures. We cannot possibly, even if we wanted to, calculate all of the costs and benefits relating to the risks that we decide to take or decide to avoid. It turns out most people are somewhat risk averse, and this matters in society. But we also know that people choose their risks in ways that are not necessarily supported by evidence. And the amount of data, you know, we're living now in a world of big data, and we have so much empirical information on the risks of various activities. And in fact, this is part of what we pay our insurance companies to do for us when we insure our car or insure our houses or insure our lives. We pay them to do the calculations on all the risks relating to those things, and, you know, based on various indicators. If it's life insurance, they want to have a snapshot of what our health situation is at the time we take out the policy. And they calculate the risks for us, and they basically present us with the information in a single dollar figure, which is the premium we pay, along with the deductibles we pay should something happen to us. So we sort of delegate out to other market participants the very important job of calculating risks for us. But these are truly insurance companies have risk adjusters. There are risk analysts in all kinds of businesses throughout the world. They participate in high-level meetings all of the time with politicians and with business leaders. And it turns out that, at least we've known for a long time, that expert judgments about risk tend to be extremely, hugely different from an average layperson's view of risk for lots of different kinds of activities.
That just piqued my interest a little bit. Do you have any kind of quick and easy descriptions as to why the expert versus layperson would come to such different conclusions?
Well, in the first place, the expert has available much more data, much more information than the ordinary layperson does and can. And they also have technical skills in computing risk based on the data that they have that most of us are never taught. And so we don't tend to use the same tools when we're computing risks. And we don't even really compute risk. As Bob mentioned earlier, we kind of intuit risks, and our intuitions can fail us often. Sometimes common sense is not very sensible, as it turns out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that does make sense, the sort of fast versus the slow and thorough approach.
Yeah, and of course, the fast approach makes perfect sense if you're undertaking an activity that has a very low-level risk, right? Because it's not going to be very costly to you should the risk, you know, manifest in some harm. But with higher-level risks, we really do need to engage more seriously in type 2 thinking.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the terms cost-benefit analysis and cost-benefit analysis. Do these differ? And I guess, you know, for me, a lot of the language kind of blurs together. As a kind of second part to this question, I would also ask, is assessment and analysis interchangeable?
Yeah, well, assessment and analysis are pretty much interchangeable, although you will often see an assessment of risk is basically the conclusion of an analysis, or the outcome of an analysis. As far as risk benefit and cost benefit, they are very similar in terms of what they are doing, but the techniques used, especially depending on the area we're concerned with, so if it's public health versus energy production versus finance, there are different techniques that are used. But risk really is just a cost. Risk is what we would call a probabilistic cost or an expected value, whereas in cost-benefit analysis, we hope to be using known values, more certain values. So you can think of risk-benefit analysis as being the same thing as cost-benefit analysis, but just with assignment of probabilities to different potential outcomes.
Uh-huh, I see. Just for our listeners, I'm guessing you're probably not talking to us from a tunnel. that's just Skype is giving us a little bit of echoiness, and I think it's kind of keeping it interesting.
Well, I don't know if my microphone is too loud or...
Oh, no, you sound good. We're just getting a little latency that it has a robotic echo. It's it's mesmerizing. But anyhow, I hopefully it's not too distracting. I'm curious. This has really piqued my interest, and I appreciate the way you're describing things. Could you give us a little bit more of a real-world example, something maybe like a simple, specific example of how risk-benefit analysis is done by experts? I mean, I've done it pros and cons, you know, column in class, but I'm guessing you guys probably use more advanced tools than that.
Yeah, with some of the factors that are being considered, so that because I'm quite certain that a lot of our listeners have no clue as to exactly what goes into risk-benefit analysis.
All right. So if we're talking about risks from chemical substances, there are about maybe more than 10,000 different chemical substances that are being used, both organic and inorganic chemicals that are in the environment that we're exposed to fairly frequently. We have a fairly detailed knowledge of only a small fraction of those chemicals. But with respect to those chemicals, we can do a pretty good risk-benefit analysis of the actual risks posed by exposure of an individual to a certain harmful chemical agent. And so what a risk analyst would do is they would look at the timing of the exposure, and they would look at the amount of the dosage, the amount of exposure the individual received, and they think about potential health effects down the line, which is a complicated business because in many cases there's a long lag time between exposure to some kind of chemical substance and manifestation of any kind of health effects or disease. For some carcinogens, it can be 30 years between exposure and disease manifestation or even longer. So what the risk-benefit analyst will try to do is try to establish a probability of having a health effect from a certain amount of exposure over a certain period of time, and the magnitude of the potential harm should the probability manifest into actual disease. That's a very simple explanation of a very complex set of techniques that analysts use in trying to model risk.
So the attempt is being made to quantify this, to use numbers, to some numbers in there. And so it seems like you're saying there are two main inputs that you need to assign values to. One is the magnitude of the risk, how serious it is, the degree of seriousness that it has, and the negative effect it would have, and probability of it actually occurring. Is that what you're saying? Those are the two main...
That's right. That's right. Uh-huh. And the outcome is it would typically be, or the expected value of the harm would be the probability times the magnitude mm-hmm. of the harm.
Okay. And a professional risk benefit analyst would go to the literature in the case of chemicals and see what kind of research has been done and then assign magnitude and probability largely based upon studies that have been done. Is that correct?
That's right. Or in some harder cases, they would actually have to collect a lot of data themselves mm-hmm. if the data hasn't been collected before. But for some, you know, fairly regularly used chemicals that are in the environment, we have a great deal of data, and for others, not so much. And those for those, it becomes harder to calculate risk. But they will go to go directly to primary data, or they will go to meta-analyses of studies that have been done in the past, or do their own meta-analysis of all of the primary studies that have been done in an effort to quantify the probability and the magnitude of harm from exposure to a certain chemical substance.
So a meta-study, just to clarify what that is, let's see if I have this right, is looking at say, all the studies that have been done on that particular issue, and then looking at the design of those studies also. So they look at the studies and the quality of the studies. Is that
That's
fairly
correct.
Accurate?
Yes, that's correct. They look at case studies. They collect a bunch of case studies.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully the case studies will all be using this, will all be conceptually similar. So people are using the same words in the same ways and meaning the same things. And they'll be methodologically similar enough so that you can actually compare them and put them all together. And a meta-analysis is a qualitative empirical technique that is often done as part of a larger study that hopefully will get to get enough data to do a quantitative analysis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to the other side of the balance beam now and talk about benefits.
Well, so benefits means the same thing in this context, really, as it means in ordinary cost-benefit analysis. And the benefits will often be better understood from the outset than the costs. I mean, if we're talking about a chemical in the marketplace, well, there's a reason it's in the marketplace, and it has an economic value imposed upon it by the market. And we know the sales figures from the manufacturers of these chemicals for a certain year. So we know what the chemical's worth. We can also calculate social benefits in terms of the number of people employed because that chemical is available on the market. A chemical may both create a risk of harm, but also provide substantial health benefits at the same time. Right. Think of the current opioid crisis. There's no question that opioids have helped people deal with pain in many circumstances, and that to that extent, they've provided social benefits. But now we're beginning to understand that the social costs, the risks created by using opioids are turning out to be much higher than those benefits.
So if I want to bring this back to critical thinkers who are lay people attempting to do something other than just, does this feel right to me? Is it do I have a sense that this is good or bad? And issues that we talk about, we don't get into the content of issues, but we try to stay with the process of critical thinking on this show. But if folks say wanted to decide, well, global warming has changed the equation a little bit in some people's mind, for example, with regard to nuclear power. So if we wanted to, say, rethink that, we thought nuclear power was too risky because of the waste, disposing of the waste products and safety issues and that kind of thing before global warming, and now we're hearing that it may be something that could mitigate global warming and buy us a little time, and we may want to rethink that, I would go, and if I was industrious enough, I would go and I would begin to brainstorm maybe what are all the risks, or I could go online and look for risks of nuclear power or benefits of nuclear power, and I could actually write those down, right? And then I could try to assign some sort of probability of those occurring and some sort of weighting, in other words, how serious they might be, and get at least some kind of an idea rather than just an intuitive quick hit on it of risk-benefit. I might be able to do that. Now, does that seem reasonable to you?
Absolutely. In fact, the work has already been done for you.
Okay, good.
You can go online and you can find existing risk assessments of nuclear. Not only that, you can find comparative risk assessments of nuclear versus coal burning, mm-hmm. for example. or nuclear versus any kind of other energy source, just as you can find comparative cost-benefit analyses for using different energy sources. But this, you know, this goes back a long time. In the 1980s, psychologist, cognitive psychologist Paul Slovic, who's at University of Oregon, did a very interesting study where he created four groups of respondents to rank a bunch of risks for different activities. And so one of the groups was the League of Women Voters, another group was college students, a third group was people who were active in clubs, they were members of clubs, and then the fourth and final group was the experts. And it's very interesting to see the difference, even way back in the 1980s, between public opinion concerning nuclear power and expert opinion. In this study, for instance, the League of Women Voters thought nuclear power was the number one risky activity or technology, riskier, for example, than handguns or, you know, anything, surgery, pesticides, anything else you can name. The experts ranked it 20th. At that time, and that's when the technology was much inferior to what we have today. And I suspect we'd have new plants up and running. I know there's one that's coming online in the United States soon, the first one in several decades. But I think we'd already have them in operation if the Japanese Fukushima nuclear accident had not occurred. Mm-hmm. Because that once again highlighted for everyone the risks associated with nuclear power, even though, as far as I know, no one has died as a result of the Fukushima nuclear accident itself.
Now, that leaves the question then of how do we know we can trust those, because there's so many people that have agendas that are out there. You could probably find two risk-benefit assessments that are completely different. Is there a source that we can go to that we can have some more confidence that is not a biased source?
Every source is potentially subject to some kind of bias, even if it's unintentional, not deliberate bias, based on, all this stuff, risk-benefit, cost-benefit analyses, all depend on certain assumptions being made. And those assumptions tend to be subjective rather than objective. So it's all contestable, but there are better sources and worse sources. And the way that science operates, and this is a point I like to make to climate change skeptics who remain out there today, is that, you know, that if you think that there's a conspiracy among all the world's scientists to support global warming, you know who's going to get most famous and most rich is the scientist who debunks it. And there have been scientists trying. The Koch brothers hired a scientist at UC Berkeley, a climatologist who had been a skeptic, to rerun all of the data, which was not an easy thing to do. And his conclusion was the situation was even worse than the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was saying at the time. And so, you know, science has this, by process, this self-correcting feature where the incentive of any good scientist is to overturn bad science.
Definitely. Well, there's a lot more to be said about this, but it is good to know that there are some sources out there that we can actually tap into without trying to recreate the wheel, at a, you know, as lay people. Let me move on, because we've been talking about risk-benefit approach, but there is an alternative approach that's called the precautionary principle. For example, the European Union invokes the precautionary principle to justify restrictions on GMOs. Can you describe that a little bit and compare and contrast that with the risk-benefit approach we've been talking about?
Well, first, I'd say they're not necessarily incompatible. Although the way the European Union uses a precautionary principle may not be compatible always with the way risk analysis is done. But the precautionary principle basically says, let's not do X until we have enough data to ensure that X is safe. As far as I know, most scientists think that that imposes too big a burden on anyone who would introduce a new technological change, anyone who would basically create a new product of any kind. The burden of proving something safe is like the burden of proving something innocent, which we don't require even in criminal trials. We just require that they say the evidence isn't sufficient to find them guilty. Right? And so the precautionary principle taken to its extreme is not necessary. It would impose huge costs itself on society. In other words, we might say that the institutionalization of a precautionary principle itself would create risks, as it almost certainly would. However, as I mentioned before, it's not necessarily incompatible with risk-benefit analysis or cost-benefit analysis, although the reasoning here is pretty technical. But the one of the most often used approaches to cost-benefit analysis uses as part of its equation a component known as the coefficient of relative risk aversion. And that figure, which actually represents a few different kinds of future possibilities, could incorporate a figure representing risk aversion, which itself is a precautionary disposition. And so you can incorporate some kind of precautionary principle into cost-benefit analysis. And in fact, arguably, it's very hard to explain modern-day environmental and health regulations without referring to them as somehow precautionary, because they're actually regulating activities or substances before the fact of harm, rather than, like the court system does, after the fact of harm.
That's a good point.
Okay. And you mentioned Paul Slovak, the professor of psychology at University of Oregon, and some of the work that he's done. And I have a little quote from him. He did find that typically people's judgments of risks and judgments of benefits are inversely related. So if we see something as having higher risk, then we tend to believe that it has low benefit, and vice versa. In fact, the quote from him is, he said, confounding of risk and benefits in people's minds, that there's a confounding of the two. So this brings up a question of, and maybe you could say a little bit about biases, values, worldviews, and how they enter into this risk-benefit analysis. This would be more lay people's issue, I think, than the experts. If the experts are going to have to justify their assignments of probability and magnitude to risks and benefits, then they're going to have something to back that up. They're going to have some research, like you said, meta-studies or whatever. So let's talk about how biases and worldviews and things like that come into the picture when as lay people, we're attempting to assess the risks and benefits of something.
Yeah, so people, as I mentioned earlier, people are taking on risks every day, whether they know it or not. They're making decisions that involve risk, and they can't avoid making decisions about risk because risks are everywhere. But they make a decision, and in deciding to get up and go to work, I'm taking a risk that I'm going to be injured on my way to work. But it's worth it because of the benefits associated with working and being productive and getting a paycheck and so forth. But for a lot of the risks that are not familiar to us, and we take on familiar risks all the time, we feel more comfortable with those. But risks that are unfamiliar, or that where we feel we're not in control of the situation, so it's not my decision whether I'm going to work, you know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Then we start to get a little skittish, and our reasoning goes a little bit haywire in those circumstances, and we don't make as good a judgment. So, for example, a lot of people are still afraid of flying in planes, even though it's gotten safer and safer, and it started out safer than driving automobiles, for example. And one of the reasons for that is just they're not in control of the airplane. They would feel safer if they were flying it, presumably. Nuclear, again, is another example of an unfamiliar risk. Genetically modified foods or organisms likewise are considered scary risks. You know, cancer is a scary risk. So those kinds of things often push us into more emotional states when we're making decisions. Another important factor is how much trust do we have in the expert who's explaining to us the risks and benefits when that's done, whether it's our oncologist if we have a cancer diagnosis, or it's the pilot of the plane, or anyone else who's trying to get us to reasonably decide on costs and benefits. In fact, in the context of surgery, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, two famous cognitive psychologists who have been working on these behavioral problems for a long time. Tversky's been dead for a long time. Kahneman is still with us, won the Nobel Prize, of course, in economics. But they showed that just depending on the way risks are presented to people by experts can lead people to make different judgments, even if the two explanations are substantively identical. So, for example, if a patient in a hospital is about to or is making a decision about undergoing surgery, let's say it's elective surgery of some sort, and the surgeon comes in and explains, with this surgery, you have a 90% risk of survival. The patients are likely to go ahead and have that surgery. If the same surgeon in that same hospital room instead says, this surgery has a 10% risk of death, patients are overwhelmingly likely not to have the surgery. This is known as a framing effect. Obviously, a 90% chance of survival and 10% risk of death are mathematically identical. And yet, just depending on how it's presented to patients will often affect the way they make decisions.
Yeah, so it's mainly, it sounds like it's the same thing, similar to what we've been talking about on this show quite a bit, which is the way these biases and heuristics that we use affect our critical thinking in general. Is going to essentially affect our risk-benefit assessments too, in a very similar way. Confirmation bias and motivated reasoning and all that kind of thing.
And certainly framing. We had a whole episode about that.
Certainly. And that is not our stomach growling in the background that you hear.
That's the dragon in the tunnel.
Yeah, I'm kind of getting to like that noise. It's sort of an interesting.
It's very cool.
Yeah, background noise.
Latency has its benefits.
Thank you for talking through it and just ignoring it, Professor Cole.
It does get me thinking though about I did enjoy our previous conversation about reframing, and it gets me thinking. You know, if you were to say first global warming and now you want nuclear power versus, you know, global warming and now we need nuclear power.
Yeah.
It's exactly, very much in the way that you can present things. Right. Anyways, I do have another question here, but I know sometimes we get folks thinking and until then, I still have another question.
Sure.
Don't get too pushy, Bob. It's all right.
This is an important question. This is.
It is. I basically, Professor Cole, being the expert on this, I'm just looking for general advice that you might have for people like myself who are critical thinking through an issue. Advice you would have for people who are trying to critically think themselves through an issue and they attempt to take into account the risk benefits involving that issue. What sort of advice would you have for them in navigating that territory?
You know, you don't have to go back to school and learn how to do, you know, these big formal risk analyses or risk assessments. You can do basically what Benjamin Franklin did, although he was doing it, we could say he was inventing cost-benefit analysis. When he was trying to make an important decision, he would take out a ledger and list all the advantages of doing it on one side and all the disadvantages on the other. And he would try to assign values ultimately to both sides of the ledger, and whichever way it came out, that's what he decided.
Like the pros and cons list.
A pros and cons list. Only with this pros and cons list, you would need to offset the pros against the cons in certain ways.
Mm.
That is, you would have to assign probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the probabilities you would want to assign, you would ask yourself, for example, what's the worst thing that could happen if I do this? And what's the probability of that happening? And you could just use, you know, a few metrics. You could use a highly likely, likely, unlikely, very unlikely. Say, take those four. And then you could go to, well, what else might happen that I'd consider really bad, but isn't the worst thing that can happen? And how probable is that? What are the good things that can happen? What's the best thing that could happen? How probable are those? And this is just a verbal way of presenting what in the literature is called a decision tree. And you would add up the expected values of each of those possible outcomes and then add them together, and you would get your outcome. The first step, of course, is for people to step back before taking a risky decision to actually say, wait, I better think this through, right? That would be a very valuable thing to do. But, you know, some of the problems that people have making good risk-benefit decisions are very, very hard, right? So, you know, the leading causes of death in the United States are heart disease and cancer, and chronic lung disease is right up there. Well, so we're talking about, aside from genetic risk factors, we're talking about eating habits. We're talking about cigarettes and other kinds of choices we want to think are voluntary, but they're, you know, maybe they're not as voluntary as we like to think. You know, maybe diets don't work. We have a lot of data on that. Exercise is very helpful, but tell that to somebody who hasn't exercised in years, and you know, how do you take that first step? And so for some kinds of decisions, you know, so it's even understandable that people would want to avoid stepping back and doing a more formal, even for themselves, analysis. Maybe I should stop eating all that ice cream. Very hard to do when the container's sitting right there in the freezer. So, but with respect to other kinds of activities, right, if somebody has to go on a long trip and it's a It's a ride on a plane. Well, if they haven't been on a plane before and they're a little anxious about it, maybe get online and look up the statistics on plane crashes. You know, one of the things about that, aside from the plane not being under your own control when you're flying as a passenger, is that the magnitude of the harm is going to be awfully high in most circumstances, right? And so whatever the probability is, you're still going to be somewhat focused on the magnitude of the harm as compared with an ordinary fender bender in your car, for example. So while flying is much safer than driving in terms of the probability of an accident, should an accident occur, most car accidents do not end in death. So it's very difficult for, you know, these are all not just risk assessments. They are risk versus risk, because there are usually risks on both sides of the equation.
Well, I think we have a caller. We're talking to Professor Cole from Indiana University, and we're talking about risk assessment, risk-benefit assessment, and we'll take our first call. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Well, someone called in and asked this question earlier. They were wondering about insurance companies, you know, they calculate risk, and how do they calculate the profit that's over and above the actual risk, and how what that usually is, how much it is?
Oh, it depends on the competitiveness of the market. If you're a health insurer, most states do not have competitive markets for health insurance, and so your profit margin can be very, very large. For automobile insurance, the profit margins are going to be less because it's a much more competitive market with more suppliers of insurance available. And that's why you see all the TV ads for different insurance companies that can save you 15% from your current insurance.
Okay, thank you.
So that's more a question about markets than risk, actually.
Yeah, right, yeah. But you can kind of get the undercurrent of what's behind that question is that in order to decide whether they're going to make a profit or not, it would be very important for their calculation to be very careful.
Well, that's right. They do need to be careful. They don't like losing money.
No.
And in fact, they will try to keep prices low for certain groups of people by taking other groups of people and putting them into separate categories.
Yeah.
That's why for many, many years, we know that the highest rates of insurance premium are for teenage boys, because they get in the most car accidents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can, and it's kind of ironic that they would be, they're actually, insurance companies are assuming your risk. So they would be doing a risk calculation to what risk there is involved.
Oh, that's right. They have to do their own internal.
Yes, exactly. But while we're waiting, let me ask you this, and this is something that you and I engaged in a little bit of email back and forth, because I'm a home brewer. And I can go to, there's at least 20 different calculators that I can go and I can put in how much malt.
Now, Bob, we always tell our callers we're not going to get into controversial topics.
Okay. All right.
Okay, go ahead, Bob.
Okay. Are ales better than lagers? No, we're not even going to go there. But I can put in the amount of hops, the efficiency of my mashing process, you know, all those kind of variables. And this calculator will crunch all the numbers and consider all the variables, the amounts of different sugar that's going to come from different malts and things like that. And so my fantasy is that as a critical thinker, that I could go online and I could find a general calculator that would, I could say what the issue is, and then it would guide me through some process of brainstorming the risks and benefits. You know, it would help me come up with a list of risks and benefits. And then I could actually assign, I probably wouldn't do the kind of literature review that experts would do. Of course not.
But you would do a beer review.
Well, presumably the website, whoever runs the website will have have that information already. That's how they do the calculations.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Yes. I mean, but wouldn't that be wonderful? It would probably be a website with a calculator, and it would be an invaluable tool to have so that we could actually then compare that information with the various different searches that we do for professionally done risks on that particular issue. And it would give us a little bit of insight and confidence in that assessment. So,
A little bit, but you know, the question would be, who's providing this tool to you, and what's their motivation?
Yeah. We'd put ads on their webpage and they could make money that way.
Yeah, the business model would be important, but I'm saying also, it's not necessarily in the interests of all big data collectors to freely share that information or the outcome of their own risk assessments with individual consumers.
Yeah.
So it's not clear to me that the private market would supply something like this of a public supplier, like maybe the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, could put up one that at least is related to all health-related risks. But then, you know, a lot of people just don't trust the government these days. They don't trust the CDC.
Yeah, I think it would be a good teaching tool, though. I'm trying to get you, Professor, I'm trying to get you interested in this as a project. You could get your students together and
this is a project. So, I actually think this is a project for the data collectors you know, the people who crunch data, which is not my expertise, but it is an excellent idea, and it certainly would be worth developing some elementary materials that could be used, for example, beginning in high schools. In high schools, and you know, I know this is a controversial topic, but in sex education classes, they do teach about risks. Of engaging in certain kinds of sexual conduct under certain circumstances. And, you know, but maybe broaden that. Maybe have a course in risks and rewards or something like that, or comparing risks. And that this might, as the children learn this and hopefully digested, it remains with them as they grow into adults. Even that wouldn't necessarily be so simple, though, because one of the reasons why there's a big anti-vaxxer campaign in recent years is because vaccines have been so successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So there's been herd immunity, and now they feel like they can protect their children better by not immunizing them, which is a very risky thing to do.
Let me, because we only have about a minute left, thank you for engaging my fantasy there. do you have a 60-second closing statement about this issue and how critical thinkers can engage with risk-benefit assessment?
In a way, in an ordinary way, it's a central component of critical thinking. Right. It's about decision making, ultimately decision making for yourself, for your family, for your friends. And it's a good idea to make make informed decisions. And to make an informed decision on a lot of important issues today, you need data. It's the world we live in. Now, the good thing is, it's on the internet. There's a lot of bad data on the internet, but if you use a certain amount of sense in terms of selecting sources, you can get really good data and make better decisions.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Professor Daniel Cole, who's a professor in both the Maurer School of Law and School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Thank you very much for
very enlightening.
Helping us through this somewhat complex topic.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Julia?
Until next month.
Until next month. Think clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, People-Powered Radio.